All right. Well, not say radio insider, podcast insider. It is Friday, the 27th, the day before the Super Bowl. We talked to David Duchovny today. Duchovny. I would say I was like a C-plus X-Files fan. I would watch it. And they're kind of standalones, too, sort of. You know, I would flip
the
around.
The earlier ones are standalones.
Yeah, it got a little too... For me, it got a little too... Now, you know, it's funny. It's sort of a precursor for all these shows now. Like, yeah. The X-Files definitely birthed sort of a whole generation of this stuff.
Absolutely.
And Duchovny became a mega star. But now he's like these actors do, you know, Johnny Depp and Russell Crowe, and there's 5 million of them. He's doing his music, and he's at the Wilbur in February, February 22nd. He's at the Wilbur, you know. If you're a fan of his, I would definitely suggest going to see it. Why not? You get to see if you're a fan of the guy, go and see him play music for 2 hours. I'm sure it'll be fine. I enjoyed the conversation. It was short. Sometimes with these stars, when they're promoting something, they're up against. I'm sure he's doing 30 of these spots today. We got about 25 minutes, maybe?
Yeah, just about 23 minutes.
I thought it was good. You know, it's one of these ones that towards the end you could tell he was like, all right, let's get to the next one. But he was absolutely fine. We talked about everything. I enjoyed it. Seems like a nice guy, laid-back guy. Obviously, he's had a real successful career. And he's one of these guys who I like because he's done a bunch of different shit. And if I had an hour or two, I think I really would have enjoyed it. But for a short sort of one-off on a week where I'm in Houston and I don't have time to do anything, probably, you're going to have to live with it, fucking deal with it. It's going to be the Duchovny. What do you think, by the way, before we go, what are the chances of us doing an actual podcast in Houston? Low?
No, I think it's actually pretty good because...
like 40 minutes with somebody in Houston in the middle of all that chaos?
The reason I say it's 100% we'll do it is because it's Glenn.
We're doing Glenn in Houston?
Yeah. Why not? Or do you want to wait till we come back? I don't. It doesn't really matter to me.
It's up to him, really. That's true. We could probably do it at night where it's a little more laid back or something, yeah, after dinner, maybe.
What I was thinking with regards to Houston was it's going to be probably like 4 people do 10 minutes.
Yeah, one of those.
In one episode, you kind of just burn through a bunch of people. It's Kirk live from, not live, but Kirk from Houston.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that type of situation.
Okay.
Which I think would be pretty good because no one's going to give us more than 10, 15 minutes.
Probably not. I don't know who we're going to get. It's so chaotic there.
It's very difficult. And you guys are off air at 9 a.m. Houston time.
Yeah, we're around. We have nothing to do. I'll be 2 minutes away, so we can figure that out. But I liked the Duchovny. Would I put it in the top 10 of the... This will be number 51, by the way.
I know.
Would I put it in the top 10? I would not. Would I put it closer to 1 than 51? Probably. I'd say it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, I'd say it's around the 15 mark.
If you're in your car for 20 minutes, you're going for a run for 20 minutes, it's fine. He seems like a nice guy, laid back. You had said there was not guidelines, but there were certain ways to start the interview per Duchovny's guy.
Yeah, his manager called me.
Right.
And talked to me for a few minutes and kind of just, he was really nice about it and pretty cool about it because he was like, listen, you know, if you start here, you'll get a great interview out of him. If you don't start there, he's going to kind of shut down and be like, what am I doing?
Right.
And if there's certain other things like, hey, don't bring that up because he won't. You know, he won't give you anything, and it's not going to be a good interview for you if he's not giving you anything if you go here, which I was very appreciative of, and I know you were too, because it's like, hey, you're actually helping us have a good interview.
You don't get a lot of that. And he's kind of laid-back sound. You know Duchovny's sort of, you know, laconic, sort of, you know, a very laid-back guy.
Dry.
But, you know, as I mentioned to him, you know, that Larry Sanders character who plays himself, who kind of has a crush on Larry Sanders, one of the great comedy things of all time, one of my favorite things ever in comedy, shows he has a sense of humor, obviously, came on. We talked about that. We talked about the X-Files, Twin Peaks, if you're a fan of that show, he's coming back on that. His music as well, as I said, he's playing at the Wilbur February 22nd, is that right? I think we've humped that enough, about 26 times between that and the podcast. So enough about me, episode number 51, is that right? David Duchovny, here it is. So you're playing the Wilbur in February, correct?
Yeah.
And I'm always sort of interested in this when, you know, people who are best known for one thing, when they sort of do something else. Was there a point when you were doing this where you at some point just said, you know what, I don't care if people think of me as an actor doing this. I just enjoy doing it. And you know, the feedback or whatever from some people doesn't matter at all. Or did that even enter your mind ever?
Well, I mean, the feedback, you know, if it's usable musical feedback, you know, then I would be interested. But, you know, in the world of Twitter, that's not really what you're going to get.
Right.
So, I mean, I assume that people are going to be skeptical, and that's their right, you know. And people like people to stay in the boxes that they are accustomed to having people in. So I get all that. And I also understand that I'm going to have a chance to have a bigger audience because of people knowing me from somewhere else. So I mean, I understand that I have an advantage of at least being able to get on somebody's radar because of some other kind of celebrity that I have. So it's not, I mean, I understand all the things that are in play, but I think music is so kind of non-prejudicial in the fact that you put on a tune and you either like it or you don't. You don't care that an actor is doing it. You don't care that a whale is making the noise. You know, if you like the noise, you like the noise. So for me, it was always like, okay, well, you can take any kind of prejudicial jokes you want to make off the top. And then if you listen to the music, you know, then you have the right to either like it or not. It's just music.
Are you less sensitive as you get older? Like, for what I do as a sports talk radio host, and we do politics and all a bunch of stuff on our show. So you'll take stuff on Twitter, and I'm 42 now. If I was doing this job when I was 22 and social media existed, I'm not sure I would be able to take it necessarily. If you just became a star today with Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all this shit, I mean, do you think you would have been able to handle it then? Does it help being older now and doing it, or does it not matter at all?
I think, well, it certainly helps to be older because, I mean, at some point you just go, well, who the fuck cares? You know, I'm just going to do what I do, you know, and that's the best that I can do. I there's no angle on it. I'm not trying to get over on anybody. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm just making music that I love, the most musical music that I can make, or whatever. You know, with the lyrics that mean something to me, and hopefully mean something to other people. That's all I'm doing. I'm not trying to be something. I'm not trying to be a rock and roll star. I'm not trying to do any shit like that. But I think when you grow up in this world of social media, I think maybe they have a different idea of their own personal feelings. I think maybe kids that grow up having been subjected to all this bullshit all the time, maybe they get harder earlier. I don't know. I know it was certainly a process for me to be able to silence other people's voices, critical voices in my head, you know, and also to be open possibly to people that have constructive things to say that are critical.
When you grew up, or, you know, the music that you like growing up, is it influenced what you do? Do you listen to music today?
Certainly.
Are we talking, you know, I'm going to guess, I don't know, is it Springsteen influenced, Neil Young influenced, or am I going somewhere else?
I certainly loved those guys when I was growing up, and I think, you know, I'm not a great musician. I'm certainly a new musician, and I don't read music, and I haven't been taught music or anything like that. So my influences are really unconscious, and I figure out my influences after I write the song. You know, it's not like I sit down to like write a song like somebody, but I certainly can hear, you know, I can hear Petty, I can hear Springsteen, I can hear hopefully, you know, like Zevon after I've written a song.
Is there always a fear when you write a song? It's like when you write anything, you're saying things. Is there always a fear when you're in the middle of writing a song and you look at it and you think, Jesus, I sound like a pretentious asshole when I write a song? You know, it's so...
Oh, yeah.
Like, a great song is so close, I think. Even some great songs are obviously pretentious. You know what I mean? There's always that edge, though, sort of, that can almost lean towards parody sometimes. You got to be careful.
I mean, you look at the lyrics on a blank piece of page without the music, and some of the great songs are... You know, they need the music to play at all. You know, without the music, they are pretentious or flat or whatever. And there's some beautiful, like, magical thing that happens between lyrics and a tune when it works. And when it doesn't work, then it remains pretentious. But there's something that happens, which is what's so amazing about, you know, pop music, pop songs.
You mentioned Petty, and he's one of those guys, right? So I'm like a massive Springsteen fan. I've seen almost 70 shows. I'm one of these losers, you know. He's just, but he's been with me since I was like 10 years old.
Yeah,
now
I understand.
It's one of those weird things where, like, you know, he taught me how to deal with my dad when I was a kid, and now as an adult, he helps me deal with my kids. It's one of these things. But Petty was always kind of behind Bruce for me, but Petty has this channel on Sirius, and he's one of these guys who, when you look at him now, like, as the total catalog, I mean, I know he's had a great career, but he's almost underrated. He's one of these guys, you'll hear, like, an unreleased Petty song, and you'll think, holy shit, like, how did this not make an album in, like, 83 or 84?
Yeah, I mean, what I love about Petty and what I respect about Springsteen as well I do a cover of a Petty song in the concert, Square One. I don't know if you know the song.
Yeah.
It's a more recent song, but but what I really respect about those guys is that you know, they've as they continue to write, they start to address the things that they're addressing as men at the age that they are at. You know, they're not writing songs about kissing girls in the back seat anymore.
Right.
You know, there, as you said, you know, he taught you how to deal with your dad. You know, Adam raised a Cain, I'm thinking.
Yes.
And that kind of stuff.
Right, of course.
And then now he's writing about his kids. Yes, and that, to me, that's an incredible thing. And for me, you know, starting at my age to write songs, you know, I couldn't write the early songs. I don't get to write the early songs.
Right.
You know, I got to go straight to... to the older songs, which has been an interesting thing, because I, you talk about pretentious. I couldn't lie and sit there and try to write songs about, you know, kissing Janie in the backseat of the car.
Did you have you written for a script ever? Have you had a script produced for a movie or television?
I wrote one movie and directed it called House of D.
House of D. That's right. That's right.
And
yes,
I wrote and directed, I think, 3 X-Files, and
How's that? Did you enjoy that process versus a songwriting process? I know it's totally different.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, you know, I love the collaborative aspect of both music and making film or television, and that, you know, you have this blueprint of, you know, for me, if it's a song, I've threw some chords together and I've got a melody and I've got some lyrics, and then I work on it with the guys in my band, and it becomes something else. And it's the same with a movie or TV, which is, you know, you got the blueprint of the words on the page, and then you give it to the actors, and you give it to the DP, and you put, you know, music under it or over it, and it becomes something completely different that you didn't expect.
Did you enjoy sort of the peak phenomenon of the X-Files? Did you enjoy being like that, sort of the peak of your fame you'll ever have in your life? Did you enjoy it at the time, or did you not enjoy it?
Well, I think I appreciated it. I probably didn't enjoy it as much as I would if I knew what I knew now then. You know, it's that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I think at the time I was afraid that was all I was going to be known for. You know, so I had a certain kind of pushback against it, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
So, and also, I wanted to, you know, go on and do other things and use the platform that celebrity had given me to go on and do other things with my life. So, you know, to appreciate something, to enjoy something, you kind of have to stand still. And I don't think I was doing much standing still at that point.
But are you cool with the idea now that for some people, and obviously you've done, you know, a million other things, California Kid, we know all the things, but are you cool with the idea that for a lot of people, that's just what you're known for now that you've, you know, you're 20 years removed from the first run of it or more?
Yeah, I mean, what I realized at one point is that I'm never going to do anything that's going to be as a phenomenon like that. I mean, because there really isn't anything like that. I mean, you could maybe Hunger Games or Twilight or something, sure. But even that's...
Yeah, but the way TV works now, it's not possible, right?
No. So I don't hunger for that kind of recognition at that scale, so it's fine. You know, I mean, it's something that I understand, and it's also something that is—it's a phenomenal thing to have happened. It is a phenomenon. So, yeah, I'm fine with that.
But you're about to be in something that's either going to have a lot of attention, right? I mean, have you shot Twin Peaks? You're done. You've shot it.
Yeah, I'm not in it a lot.
Right.
You know, that wasn't like a running thing.
Yeah. But you're in the new one.
Yeah.
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 And working with Lynch is an experience you enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, he's a genius. I mean, I don't use that word lightly. He's a man who has a complete and unique vision of what he wants to do. And it's a beautiful feeling to be in that, you know, it's very secure. You know what I'm saying?
Sure, but you're at the point of your career now, like, you know, you're doing this music stuff, and like I said, you'll be at the Wilbur in February.
Yeah.
You're sort of at the point now, I'm guessing, in your career where you're able to pick and choose what you want. It's got to be sort of comforting. You weren't able to do that, I'm guessing, 25, 30 years ago.
No, I mean, you know, show business is hard. You're never, like, I mean, it's very rare that you get to a place where you can pick and choose, and it doesn't last that long, you know, for anybody. So show business is fickle, and it's difficult. And, yeah, I have more choices at my disposal right now than I used to. But, you know, that could go away tomorrow, or, you know, all I got to do is make a couple of wrong moves. So it's like, but I, then again, I don't care as much. Like, I'm kind of just doing stuff that I feel is worthwhile, or that I feel is challenging, or that I feel is entertaining.
Did you think, though, like, when and I'll get back to the music in the book, which is relevant too here in a second, but did you get to a point in your career, like, when The X-Files hit, you started doing some of these movies. Did you do movies because you thought you had to do them, some of them? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was probably susceptible to that thinking at that point, that there was a qualitative difference between television acting and movie acting, and I wanted to prove myself as a movie actor, which I don't believe anymore. I believe television has probably
it surpassed it for sure.
Yeah. So and I think, you know, I was working at a time when that was happening, when television was starting to do the work that movies used to do.
Right.
So, but at the time, I thought it was also like it was a creative choice. You know, if I could go movie to movie, then, you know, I wouldn't have to do the same character for years at a time, or for 10 months at a time, stuff like that. But then that was probably why I valued at that point being in movies more than I valued being in television.
Do you think?
Which I don't anymore.
But you were still a guy who, you know, at the time, you're a big star. You're starting to break out. X-Files is huge. You're in these in these big movies, and still you do what I consider one of the, I don't know, five funniest cameos in television history on Larry Sanders, which is one of the great running recurring characters. I know you're asked about it all the time.
Yeah.
Of all time. I mean, that's that. I remember watching the time and thinking, geez, you know, TV stars from 10 or 15 years ago would never play a character who pretends to have as a homosexual crush on Larry Sanders. Like, I couldn't imagine. I don't know, who was a TV star 15 years before that? John Ritter, or, you know, fucking like Gavin McLeod. Like, I don't see that happening, you know?
Right.
Like, how did that, you know, I'm sure you've told the story a bunch, and I'm you know, if you're bored about it, I understand, but.
No, I'm not
like,
bored. I'm not bored talking about Gary.
How does that, what's the genesis of that?
Well, I had wanted to be on that show for as long as I'd seen it, and I was up in Vancouver, and my manager at the time would send me VCR cassettes. This is how long ago it is. Mm-hmm. And I would watch the Larry Sanders Show, and I just thought, this is the funniest show I've ever seen. This is the greatest writing. And just please get me on that show, whatever you need to do. I wanted to do SNL, and I wanted to do Sanders. And they were kind of like my showbiz checkpoints. I wanted to do Letterman. I wanted to do SNL. I wanted to do Sanders. You know, it's like, then I'll know that I've made it. And I got to do one show with Gary, and I met Gary, and we became friends, and he invited me to his basketball game and played weekly game over there. And at some point, we just started talking about coming back again and doing one where I think I said, you know, it'd be funny if I had a crush on you, but it wasn't sexual. And this was before the whole man crush thing. We didn't have the words for it, you know. And he said, yeah, that'd be funny. And we just kind of riffed on it. And, you know, 3 weeks later, I was in my trailer in Vancouver, and, you know, here comes the Sanders script. And, you know, that was how he did it. You know, Gary was just, I miss him dearly.
They replayed, you know, obviously after he passed, they replayed a whole bunch of on HBO. They did a bunch of marathons. And I was randomly watching the first, might have been the first one.
Yeah.
And you called him on the phone, you're talking back and forth, and you're like, I'll be in town Saturday. And he's like, no, Saturday, I think I'm not going to be in town. You just want to hang out with him so bad, he has no interest in hanging out with you at all. Like, it's illogical, and I guess that's what makes it so funny.
Yeah.
And obviously the basic instinct thing with the robe and all that stuff.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, the scene that you're referring to where I'm talking to him on the phone.
Yeah.
I was actually in my trailer in Vancouver, and Gary said, I think we can shoot the scene right now, because they never shot my side of it. It's only my voice. And so he called as Gary, and we just kind of improvised that. So that's what you hear is the actual phone call.
Oh, it's actual conversation?
Well,
no script.
Know,
I mean, yeah, right. Yeah, right.
We knew what we were going to do.
Guidelines, yeah.
But that's me, you know, in a suit as Mulder in my trailer in Vancouver, just calling Gary, you know, on a lot somewhere in L.A.
Did you, and you obviously, I'm guessing, were pretty good friends with them all the way through?
Yes, well, we became great lifelong friends and you know, just great friends.
And he's another guy who seemed like, you know, he did exactly what he wanted to do. Like, he didn't, you know, the sellout's a cliche, but you know what I mean. He did what he wanted to do.
He did, and that was both his gift, and it was a bit of a curse for him because he was very, very painstaking in the kind of work that he would do, and therefore, you know, people would always say, well, why hasn't Gary done another show, and why doesn't Gary work more? Well, it was because it had to be good enough. It had to be the way he wanted it to be, and show business is not set up that way.
So what is a Duchovny set list? How long is the show? I'm used to these, like, four-hour Springsteen shows. So
no,
when I, no. Am I getting, you know, 38 songs?
And you're
stage diving? None of that stuff.
I don't have a catalog, although Springsteen's stage diving, and he's got more people to dive into. I might hurt myself if I stage dive.
No Springsteen covers?
No. I'm going to do a Velvet Underground cover.
Okay.
We're going to do a band cover.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do, I do a Bowie cover. I do a Petty cover myself. Mm-hmm. And then I play for about 2 hours. I play a good 2 hours. And we're going to do probably almost the album. And then maybe four or five tunes off of the new album that comes out in the spring.
Excellent. That'll be in February. In your book, your novel, which came out last year, which I have to ask you about, the actual technical title is not Bucky Fuckington, right? It is Bucky. The word fucking is not used, right? You put something over
the
U.
Well,
you use it. Okay.
And the title is an asterisk where the U should be.
Asterisk is the word I'm looking for. I should probably know that word by now.
Yeah.
In the plot, and that came out, I want to say, in 2016. Am I wrong?
It came out opening day last year.
Opening day last year. Do well?
Yeah.
You enjoy?
I mean, you know, books are. Books is a whole other thing where you know, you want people to be buying more books, but they're not. And I think, you know, if you're working outside of, like, the thriller genre, if you're working outside of genres, it's even harder to sell books. But I get to publish another one, so I guess it did well enough.
And the plot is, in just, you know, for people who are listening, they're around here, they may want to grab it. Is somebody's work? I could be wrong. Somebody working for the Yankees?
Well, he sells peanuts at Yankee
Stadium. He's a
vendor.
Stadium. Okay.
I don't know if that makes.
Yeah, it's
him
not
work
quite.
For
it's not
Yankees.
Quite an employee. So he's a vendor at Yankee Stadium. Yeah,
yeah. And his he's kind of estranged from his father. And you might like this if you're a father and son fan. But he moves in with his father after a long estrangement because his father's dying of cancer, and his father's a big Sox fan. And he's obviously working for the Yankees, as you say. And the son at one point figures out that his father's health or his well-being is dependent on whether the Sox are winning or losing. And of course, we know that in '78,
right,
you know, they're gonna start to tank, and
right,
the Yankees are gonna tie them at the end. So there's a middle part of the book is kind of like this ruse, faking outcomes that the son is doing for the father as the Sox start to lose. By the use of the new technology called a video cassette recorder. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I remember growing up, and I remember taping Red Shoe Diaries and watching my VCR the next morning.
Whoa, good man.
Are we going to see, with all these TV shows that reboot and come back, we're not going to see Jake Winters come back?
You don't want to see an old man doing that.
Getting massages from, that's a dumb question, but, like, is that an odd experience while it's happening? I mean, is it in any way, like, sexual or no?
Well, you mean talking about doing a love scene?
No, but like the Red Shoe Diaries, if I remember, like, you'd be getting massaged by these women in, like, intro scenes, right?
No.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, Red Shoe Diaries, I was really, like, after the first...
Yeah, you were gone?
I would just read the letters, and then it would become...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So I was just a lonely guy with a dog reading letters.
Would you read those, like, were you trying to read those as an actual actor, or were you sort of tongue-in-cheeking it, like, were you in on the joke?
No, I was not. I was just like, man, I'm getting paid to do this. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's true. You just basically started, right?
Yes, exactly.
And do you think, were you surprised And again, I'll let you go on there. Up against it, and you get your show, as I said, in the Wilbur's in February.
Yeah.
Were you surprised at the success X-Files had last year when it came back? And are you going to do it again?
We're talking about doing some more. Should have some news, either yes or no, pretty soon. Was I surprised? I don't know. I mean, I just felt like there was such a kind of a groundswell of support for it coming back that I just felt like there was this huge loyal fan base that was there. So in a way, I wasn't surprised, but maybe I should have been.
I guess not. What surprised me was how, you know, because I liked, obviously, a big fan of the show. I really liked the movies, but that last movie sort of came and went. It was odd.
Yeah.
It was almost like it wasn't promoted. It wasn't talked about. And then Friday, it just showed up, like, in the movie theater. Is that...
Well...
No? Is that inaccurate?
Well, it's not inaccurate. I think it was a conjunction of a few different factors. One, it was kind of dark subject matter.
Right.
It was about a pedophile priest, and, you know, it was an X-File around this particular character, played really well by Billy Connolly. But it also came out the weekend, I think, after Batman.
Oh, yeah.
And it was kind of put in the theaters as a summer blockbuster. And, you know, we can make a summer blockbuster, X-File, but that wasn't it. So I think it was a $30 million picture, you know, and it was
right.
supposed to compete with these $100, $150 million movies. So it was just a bad, I think Fox kind of dropped the ball on the franchise.
It's funny, I'm talking here on Friday, and last night I finished The Fall on Netflix,
yeah.
which I hadn't watched, which is a damn good show.
It is good, yeah.
She was excellent in that show, right?
Yeah. Yeah, very, very, very good. Very great, yeah.
Have you thought about doing stuff like that, sort of Netflix stuff? Or I mean, I guess script is good, right?
Absolutely. It's a whole new world out there. There's so many different vendors who are doing great material, and they don't have to think about reaching a huge audience anymore, and therefore they can kind of hit a niche audience and do really good work.
Right. Well, I'll let you run. I know you're up against it. February 22nd, you'll be at the Wilbur. David Duchovny, you'll be playing.
Thank you.
For, I'm going to say, at least 3.5 hours, maybe 4 hours. No, 2 hour show. Do we have a tour name? Is there a tour?
It's really Hell or High Water.
Hell or High Water. So, that's the album, right?
Yeah, it's the album.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So it'll be February 22nd, the Wilbur. David, we appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
All right. Thanks again for listening to the Enough About Me podcast. Actually, you know what? I'm really not thankful at all. You should be thanking me. You get this shit every week, these great podcasts, totally free. Do me a favor. Would you go to iTunes, download it, go to Stitcher, do the same, and leave a rating, leave a review. That's where you can help me out. This podcast is going to be number one again. I guarantee it. And you're going to help me along with the process. So for that, I guess at the end, maybe I will thank you. There's a lot of thank yous going back and forth. Here's the point. Fuck you.